Hello everyone, my name is Francis Donald and I'd like to welcome you to this sixth session in an ongoing series of webinars on sacred number and geometry. Please feel free to ask questions or make comments anytime during the webinar. Just raise your hand digitally, you have that button that you probably remember at this point, or use the text box and BL will open the floor to you. So last month, we looked at the Vesa Kapisis as a means for synthesizing the great invocation in meditation. After meditating with this symbol these last few weeks, I've come to the conviction that the square root of 3, the line descending from the upper point, which we chose to represent the love aspect, is the governing Fohatic principle of the Vesa Kapisis. So I suggest this simplification if you're using this symbol in your meditation. Instead of visualizing this line, which represents phi, simply visualize the line of descent originating at the center of the circle on the right, representing the point of light. This simplification gives us a unified down pointing arrow depicting the descent of light and love and power. I also found it useful to visualize myself sitting in the lower triangle of the Vesa Kapisis, as shown in this illustration, which I created to announce the Gemini full moon a few years back, while at the same time imagining the descent of this square root of 3 entering my head chakra and moving down into my heart. So these are just suggestions. I encourage you to modify any visualizations, to personalize them for your own use and according to your own intuition. Okay, before we move into threeness, which will be the main thrust of today's webinar, let's take a look at a few final points on the number 2. Considered mathematically, the number 2 is the first prime number and the only even prime number. Prime simply means that a number is divisible only by itself and the number 1. The Greeks believed that 1 and 2 were not numbers at all, but were rather the parents of all numbers. Thus, they believed the first true number to be 3. They considered 2 to be the midway point, a kind of door between unity and all that follows, right? All plurality. And they believed this was proved by the fact that 2 plus 2 equals 2 times 2. Thus, 2 was seen to be the numerical representative of equality. In fact, you may remember that in earlier times, 2 and the equal signs were written in the same way. I presented this slide a couple of months ago. It's the progression of the way 2 is written. One of the most fascinating aspects of the ancient Greek study of numbers was that they ascribed specific subjective qualities to each number. For instance, they believed that the dyad, because it was the first number to endure separation, represented anguish, endurance, loneliness, and hardship. On this point, they would probably have disagreed with Three Dog Night on just which is the loneliest number. Astrologically, 2 manifests in many ways. Of the 3 crosses, the fixed cross with its equal horizontal and vertical arms is most closely related to the number 2. Indeed, it is the polarity of spirit and matter that forms the cross on which one has reached the midway point, must be crucified. This esoteric catechism, presented as a dialogue in Initiation Human and Solar, graphically depicts the nature of the fixed cross. And I'd like to bring in a volunteer to read this passage. Would somebody like to step forward, be brave, and read this passage? BL, do we have any volunteers.
No intrepid volunteers yet. Come on, folks. Still no volunteers. Raise your hand. There we
Is
go.
everybody?
We got
Great.
it. Okay, go ahead, please, Scott.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
No. You can.
Yes.
Terrific. What causeth then the cross? How mount you by its aid? The cross is formed by aspirations, instilled by godlike urge, which cut athwart the lower world desires, implanted by the life developed from below. Explain more clearly what you mean and how the cross becomes the way. The arms that form the cross become the great dividing line, placed betwixt the lower and the higher. Upon those arms, the hands are nailed, the hands that grasp and hold, ministering to the lower needs, trained thus through many eons. Lo, when the hands are helpless held and cannot grasp and hold, the inner life slips from its sheath, mounting the limb aright, upright. It passeth from the lower forth, and the cross doth bridge the gap.
Thank you. The fixed cross is graphically depicted by one of the tarot cards. Not the second arcanum, as might be expected, but rather the 12th, the Hanged Man, one of the most esoteric cards in the tarot arcana. Cosmically, this arcanum represents the cross of matter, illustrating what happens when the one of spirit moves into the two of the form world, which in sequence, one and two, gives us the 12 of the hangman. It also adds to three. The color of his garments confirms this, the one of red and the two of the blue or indigo. From the perspective of the path of discipleship, this card represents the fourth initiation, as illustrated by the four formed by his cross legs. You may remember that the fourth initiation is the crucifixion. The triangular shape of his arms symbolizes spirit. His inverted position on the cross represents spirit immersed in matter. Numerically, a crucifixion is the reversal of the three and the four, a spirit fixed on the cross of matter, as shown in this arcanum. So, in this one arcanum, we have not only the one, the two, the three, and the four depicted in terms of their philosophical implications, but we also have the three numbers of completion, the seven, depicted by the three and four in the body of the hangman, the 10 of the tractus, which is confirmed by the 10 buttons on his tunic in the Bota version, this version. And we also have the cosmic 12, 3 times 4, the number of the arcanum. But this just begins to touch on the profound implications of the hangman. Paul Foster Case hints at its deeper meaning in this quote from his book, The Tarot. Could we get another reader? This one's a little shorter. Somebody be willing to read this? I'll be showing three slides, so just keep reading as I move from slide to slide. Any other volunteers?
No volunteers yet. Come on, folks.
It won't hurt, I promise. Not much, anyway.
Here we go.
Great.
Terry, go ahead.
Terry, are you on self-mute or do you have your headset turned on? Terry, we had trouble with you in the faculty meeting this way too. I'm not hearing you. What a shame. Well, I appreciate your willingness.
Now you're on self-mute. Now you're unmuted.
Is there a separate button on your headphone, Terry, that is mute, a mute button? If so, give that a click and see if that helps.
Nope, we have another hand though, so.
Okay. Sorry, Terry. I hope we work this out. Someone yesterday was talking about helping you get this fixed. So hope that happens.
Okay. Go ahead, Guadalupe.
Okay. The head of the hangman is LUX, Lux in manifestation as the Logos. He is the Ancient of Days reflected into the incarnate life of personality. One of the old occult names of the One Life is Lux, which is Latin for light. The sum of the Roman numerals L, V, and X is 65, the numeration of the Hebrew name Adni, Adonai, Lord, the Tarot by Paul Foster Case.
Thank you, Guadalupe. I appreciate that. Where are you?
In Victoria, Canada.
Oh, that's right. I remember. Yeah. Great. Well, thanks for tuning in today.
Thank you.
Okay. Someday I'd really like to do a webinar series interpreting the Tarot in terms of the works of the ancient wisdom teachings. That would really be fun to do. Just go straight through the deck with that. But for now, back to the astrological significance of the number 2. Ruled by the second ray, Gemini, which DK calls the major symbol of duality in the zodiac, is our strongest representative of the number 2. DK tells us, it is the constellation Gemini and its inherent second ray influence which control every one of the pairs of opposites in the great wheel. Thus, like the high priestess, Gemini is the mediator between the pairs of opposites. It's worth noting that the fourth and fifth rays, which are the rays of the exoteric and esoteric ruling planets of Gemini, right, Mercury and Venus, represent the two numbers most closely allied with the number 2. As revealed in our analysis of the yin-yang symbol a couple of months ago, suggesting that the yin-yang is more relevant to Gemini than a superficial examination of its pairs of opposites may suggest. Pisces is also a dual sign, concerned with the blending of soul and form. And we touched on this in a previous webinar as well. This blending of soul and form reaches a point of balance in Libra, expressed in the esoteric keywords, I choose the way, which leads between the two great lines of force. DK tells us that Libra represents the consciousness of duality and the effort to balance the two. So, you know, these are just three signs that represent, that are very specific in their use of duality, though they approach it from different perspective. Jupiter is the planet associated with the, DK also tells us that the sign Aquarius is a dual sign and signifies two vibrations, substance and the anima mundi, or imprisoned soul, which begin to work in mutual tolerance. Okay, now on to Jupiter. Jupiter is the planet associated with the second ray. One important influence of this sacred planet is to resolve the duality of head and heart and bring them into synthetic interplay. But it's Mercury that is, as the old commentary says, the divine intermediary, which carries messages between the poles with speed and light. DK tells us that Mercury is the expression of the dual aspect of the mind as it mediates between the higher and the lower. Okay, this is just a really quick list of the impact of duality in astrology. We could so easily do a full webinar on this one subject alone, but we need to move on. The state of consciousness most closely associated with the number 2 is transmutation. Desire becomes aspiration. Selflessness is transformed into self-forgetfulness, and self-service becomes selfless service. All shifts associated with the fixed cross, an arena of activity, I would guess, familiar to everyone here. Okay, duality is an intrinsic part of all temple and cathedral construction. No matter what the design, there is almost always an area for those visiting the temple and an area representing the spiritual reality that the temple was designed to invoke. These two areas can take many forms. Where there is a dome, which always symbolizes the transcendent half of the sphere cut by the diameter, the entire floor level represents the exoteric aspect of the temple. So we have an above and a below represented by the upper half sphere and the implied lower half sphere, which is the entire ground floor. But the floor level is also usually divided into a sitting or standing area and some form of altar. The sitting area is expressive of the personality-soul dichotomy, the duality associated with those visiting the temple, whereas the priests, ideally soul-infused, emphasis on the word ideally, are working with the soul-monad dichotomy, represented respectively by the altar and the dome. You can see the priest did the very lowest part of this photograph. Okay, to wrap up our discussion on the number two, let's take a look at the names given by DK and Esoteric Psychology 1 of the second Ray Lord. Since this great Ray Lord embodies the highest expression of Tunis, you may wish to reflect on the nature this number as the list is read. And you know what's coming next. Well, I'd like another volunteer, if we could, to read this list. Maybe you might choose to pause for just a second after each name. Do we have a volunteer, BL? Just wait until we do.
Yes, we
it
do.
It always takes a minute. Great.
No, we do.
Great.
Go ahead, Asha.
Ray 2, love, wisdom. His symbol, the second purpose of deity.
We can hardly hear you.
Is this better?
Speak some more. It's a little better.
Ray 2, love, wisdom. Yes, you can hear me?
Mm-hmm.
His symbol is the thunder, the word that cycles down the ages. Some of the names of this Ray Lord which convey his purpose are as follows. The Displayer of Glory, the Lord of Eternal Love, the Cosmic Magnet, the Giver of Wisdom, the Radiance in the Form, the Master Builder, the Conferrer of Names, the Great Geometrician, the one who hides the life, the cosmic mystery, the light bringer, the Son of God incarnate, and the cosmic Christ.
Thank you, Asha. Appreciate that. Note the duality inherent in many of these names. Like, we have the displayer of glory, not the glory, but the displayer of glory, right? The cosmic magnet, suggesting that polarity, and the giver of wisdom. You see, as you go through, the conferrer of names, there's this sense of the duality, not to mention the Son of God incarnate. Okay, in our last webinar, we used the Vesa Capices as a symbol for the great invocation, with the specific goal of having a synthetic experience of that invocation. But of course, there are many other ways to apply this symbol. The Vesa Capices is arguably the single most important geometrical figure in sacred geometry. Euclid considered it important enough to be the subject of the first postulate in his masterwork, The Elements. It was used as the determining geometrical template for constructing the great European cathedrals in the 11th and 12th centuries, such as Notre Dame in Paris. So even though we've already adapted it to the Great Invocation, let's backtrack a bit and submit this symbol to the method for study suggested by DK in the Introduction to Glamour, a World Problem. We use these methods in our analysis of the yin-yang symbol. You may remember that DK divides his approach into three segments, beginning with the exoteric approach. Could we get someone to read this instruction? A fourth reader?
I don't see any hands yet.
Let's wait a bit.
There we go. Go ahead, Arrest.
Good morning, Arrest. Good morning. Exoterically, this involves study of its form as a whole, of its lines, and therefore of its numerical significance, and also study of its sectional forms, by which I mean its arrangements.
Thank you, Arrest.
Introduction to Glamour, World Problem.
So what can we say about the line quality, the numerical significance? You can see the vesica in the background of this slide. And the arrangement of the forms that make up the vesica pieces, just its attributes. At this point, we're not looking for meaning or significance, but rather for a tabulation of this figure's physical attributes. It'd be great if you would like to jump in on this. When called on, just describe a single physical attribute. You may remember doing this a couple of months ago with the yin-yang symbol. Don't be shy. Your observation can be quite simple, like the ones listed here. To save time, I'm not going to go into my computer and type these out. It just takes a little more time than I'd like. But nonetheless, let's list these qualities that are purely physical concerning the vesica pieces. It's fine, in fact, necessary to cite attributes described in last month's webinar. So we have already listed, we have the first is just a definition. Two circles with the same radius, which intersect in such a way that the center of each circle lies on the perimeter of the other. And then the second is a quite obvious observation. All the lines in the vesica pieces are curvilinear. But obvious doesn't mean unimportant at all. So anything at all that may occur to you, let's hear what you have to say here.
No hand. Here we go. Go ahead, Arrest.
Merging, co-joining, sort of a coming together, a meeting.
Mm. Yes, you know, actually, Arrest, that will be, I believe that would fit better under the second topic, which would be the subjective implications of the symbol. At this point, we're looking strictly for the physical attributes, though saying that they are conjoining is certainly relevant to this part of the study. Anyone else? Anything at all? And it doesn't have to be just what you see, it's what's...
I have several hands.
Oh, terrific.
Go ahead, Nicole.
Hi, guys. I'm not sure whether that's correct, but it looks to me like the two intersecting points of the circles, one on top and one at the bottom, may be the same as the two centers. Would they be the same length? It would form like a cross. If we put a line at the center, mm-hmm. It forms a cross.
It does indeed.
Two imaginary lines.
It does indeed. Actually, the relationship of the length of those lines is very interesting. It's the, if you were to draw a line through the whole width of the two circles, right, from one side of the figure to the other, and then you compare that to the heights of the two points you're describing, you would have 3 in comparison to the square root of 3, the square root of 3 being the height. If you just drew a line through the center part, like it would be the base of the equilateral triangle that's implied there, hint, hint, then you would be 1 in relation to the square root of 3. So they're not the same, but they're definitely in numerical relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Nicole.
Okay, I have three comments from a couple of people and then one more hand up. So,
okay.
Allison says the two crescents are mirror images.
Absolutely correct. Yeah.
Catherine says there are 3 segments. The circles cross twice at the top and bottom.
Very good.
And Linda says an exoteric attribute is that there are three open spaces created by the circle.
Very, very good. Yes, indeed.
Okay, and now a hand up? Or did you want to comment before?
No, keep going.
Okay, here, before I go to the hand, I got one more here. The line through the width in both centers equals 3 radii.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, if you were to extend a line all the way across, it would be the width of 3 radii. Correct. Yes, and I'll get into that a little bit in a moment. Right.
Okay, Guadalupe, go ahead, please.
A lot has already been said, but I thought that one line forms one circle, another line forms the other circle, and then 2 lines form the vesica piscis, and then 4 lines form the cross intersection on top and bottom.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Yes. Thank you, Guadalupe. Say hi to your little friend, Guadalupe. Anyone else have any physical concepts connected with this? We've covered quite a bit. Any more hands, Pia?
I don't see any more hands.
Okay,
and I don't
that's
see
fine.
Any more comments.
All right, so let's move on. Now, here's some of the ideas that were covered, and there's also some new ideas, right? 3 spaces of equal width, which was mentioned, right? And these are, each of these is a radii, right? The length of one radii. Thus, 3 non-overlapping circles whose diameter is equal to the radius of the large circles, right, the diameter equal to the radius of the large circles, can be drawn side by side in these 3 spaces. Of these 3 circles, circles 1 and 2, which I've illustrated here, or 2 and 3, give us a template for the yin-yang symbol, don't they? Thus allowing us to do all that we were able to do with the yin-yang symbol, as, for instance, squaring the circle, which you can see in the very light blue outlines there, and the creation of the pentagon. Now, I'm not going to go back through how that was done, but if you were here a couple of webinars ago, you may remember that we were able to both square the circle and create a pentagon just with the 2 small circles that represent the radius of the larger circle. So, of course, we have that as available in the vesica piscis. Here's a crop circle that depicts this union of the yin-yang symbol and the vesica piscis. It also contains 2 axes, which Nicole brought out. The first created by the combined diameter of the 2 circles, is horizontal. The second, created by the vesica pisces proper, that's the center section, is vertical. And as you can see, they're in a relationship of 3 to the square root of 3. All right. As mentioned last month, if we square the base with the sides of the vesica pisces, the resulting triangle is 51 degrees and 51 minutes, which is identical to the slope of the Great Pyramid of Giza. This and only this angle allows for the squaring of the circle when using the height of the pyramid as the radius. The vesica pisces mathematically birthed 6 of the first 8 polygons. Note that the length of all the sides of all the polygons are the same as the radius of the circle. Now, we're not going to get into the mechanics of how each of these polygons are formed, but we can easily visualize the square, which is created, it's, you can see quite easily, by just simply extending the radius of each of the circles until it reaches the perimeter and parallel to each other, and then connect the line at the top. The square and the double square give us 2 of the 5 transrational functions that are found within the vesica pisces. 2 very important ones, I may add, the square root of 2 and the square root of 5. So all these are just physical characteristics of the vesica pisces. And now that we have some idea of them, we can begin to extract significance. And to do that, let's move into the second of DK's methods for understanding a symbol. So, would somebody be willing to read this little bit longer section on the conceptual quality of the figure, or the conceptual quality of how to study a geometrical figure or a symbol? BL, any volunteers?
Not yet.
Okay, let's just hold on.
Here we go. Go ahead, Leah, please.
Morning. Conceptually, conceptually, this involves arriving at its underlying idea, which may be expressed in its name. At its naming, as that emerges in the consciousness through meditation, and at its significance as a whole or in part. You should, when doing this, bear in mind that the idea connotes the higher or abstract intent, that the meaning is that intent expressed in terms of the concrete mind, and that its significance has in it more of an emotional quality and might be expressed as the type of desire it arouses in you.
Thank you, Leah. Okay, DK ascribes meaning to the concrete mind and significance to the emotional realm. So if you think back on the ideas that we had concerning its physical attributes, what meaning or significance can we derive from those? With the possible exception of the circle, it's doubtful that any geometric figure has been used as a template for more meaning and significance as much as the vesica pisces has. It's been used throughout the ages as a symbol that has meaning inherent in its qualities. So we spent half of the last webinar associating this symbol with the ideas expressed in the Great Invocation. So what additional meaning and significance can we derive from this symbol? To help us get comfortable with this mode of thinking, I just listed one here. It's a very simple idea. And we can add to it Arrest's idea. I'll read this one, and then Arrest, if you would, maybe re-describe what you had said earlier, restate. This one is, it is the first figure with a beginning, middle, and end. which is the essence of threeness. Okay.
It's also, I mentioned merging, but what's coming to me more is that it's both the womb of creation and it's also the eye that sees all that comes forward.
Mm. Are you speaking of like this vesica proper, the central segment, has the shape of an eye? Is that what you're saying? Or that the entire figure is like an eye? Orest? Anybody there?
He's on self-mute.
Oh, okay. Okay.
The mandala. The mandala is
right.
The eye. It's the womb. It's the yoni. And from it comes the plenum, the whole of creation.
Absolutely. Yes. That this is a very popular understanding of the vesica pieces, and it's physically demonstrable. Remember the slide of all the different shapes issuing forth, right? It gives birth to the triangle, the square, the pentagon, the hexagon, the octagon, and the decagon, just right off the bat. Great. Any other thoughts about its subjective potential?
We have a couple of comments, and then Leia has her hand up. So go ahead, Leia.
Just following on from Arist, it's the seed.
Yeah, it is. It looks like a seed, and I like that. You know, I don't have that in my list. Thank you. I'm going to add that, because the seed suggests the full potential of the final stage of what the seed is, right? And yeah, the central portion, especially the vesica, has that quality. Thank you. Any other ideas?
Yes, we have an idea here from Claire. And then I see another hand. So Claire says, if we turn the circle clockwise by 90 degrees, and depending on how one chooses to draw them, two equilateral triangles fit within the two interfaced circles, with either their bases or interpenetrating points becoming the points of connection and separation within yoni portion of the diagram. This in turn alludes to the Antikarana as the central point in individual soul personality fusion, as evoked in the triangle's meditation, and two, references the group soul in group alignment. And she says she wishes she could draw it.
Terrific. Well, I do have a drawing of the vesica pieces turned vertically, that is one circle above the other, so that might help us visualize your concept a bit. Of course, we have two equilateral triangles that naturally fit in the shape of the central area, sharing a common base, no matter which way we turn it. But I'm intrigued by the, I got the sense that that's not what you were referring to, that what you're talking about is, I believe, using the entire figure. Both the circles, and then and if you extend the triangles to their full size, so that the triangle is as large as the entire circle, and then those two together make an interpenetrating equilateral triangles. Am I correct in my assessment of what you said, Claire?
Am I unmuted, Francis?
Yes, you're unmuted.
Oh, hello. Hi, everyone. yes, it's complex to describe, because I was actually thinking more in terms of, well, I see exactly what you're saying there, of if we look at the drawing as you had it initially, with the bases of the triangle on the exterior diameter, with their points facing inwards into the yoni part of the diagram, then we end up with the points touching and intersecting at the same time. Does that make sense? And if you flip them around, then you have the bases in coherence.
I see. Yes, yes. Okay. Yeah.
It's very difficult to describe it without...
Difficult to describe. I mean, you know, the simplest things to draw are the most difficult to describe. Indeed. Jump in if I bring up a slide that would help illustrate what you're... I'm tempted just to go to Adobe Illustrator right now and and have you guide me through it, but we can't do that. So if I come up with if I present a slide that brings us, that is close to what you just described, jump in and let us know.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks. Okay. All right, so...
Nicole
yes?
has a comment.
Mm-hmm.
When I look at these circles, I visualize them as if they are three-dimensional. And the middle, the what looks like an eye, and Orest mentioned that earlier on, reminds me of the third eye, which uses then the two eyes as distribution points. And the figure or the geometrical figure of a diamond is right in the middle, and this figure, no, just a minute. DK describes the soul as the diamond soul.
Mm-hmm.
And the third eye really is the agent of distribution of the soul. It uses that as its, because it is an etheric pineal gland. So to me, that looks like a third eye using the two eyes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as distribution points for the soul, for the diamond soul.
Mm-hmm. Well, just the two equilateral triangles with its sharing a baseline in the middle creates a diamond shape.
Yes.
And it also is subjectively suggestive of the descent of light, because it takes you from the upper point to the base point.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah. Now, I've pulled back the slide that I had earlier because you mentioned it three-dimensionally, and that was my intent in the creation of this image that you have, what it would look like if you had two spheres. And then many of our concepts, you know, become, for instance, the idea of the seed, you know, is really brought to life with this. It's really the shape of seed here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you for that. Let's see, I'll get back on track here. Any other ideas?
Yes, you have another hand up. Guadalupe,
okay.
Go ahead. Oops.
Yes, if you turn the physical Pisces horizontally and lose the distal arms of this outer circle, you have the shapes of galaxies in the universe. And then also goes to the distribution of energy when a nova, supernova, or any of those form. The rotation is that way.
Uh-huh. Interesting. So in the distribution of energy, your first comment about the galaxies, could you restate
galaxies.
That? Yeah, the galaxies.
Yes.
State
when
that
you
again.
Have the physical Pisces in the horizontal form, the way that you have it now, and let's say in the right hand, you have the beginning up to three quarters, and you lose the third part, and then starting that bottom circle there and go and lose the one third in the top.
Mm-hmm.
That is how galaxies rotate in the shape of a
oh,
galaxy.
I see. Uh-huh. Yes,
and,
yes, yes.
And usually when a nova, supernova, any of those stars go, and a star goes supernova, there is that rotation about the circle that forms that inner eye, and the distribution of energy goes either inward to outward to expand or inward to implode.
Indeed. In fact, there's a galaxy called the Hourglass Galaxy.
That's correct.
Which is really misnamed because it doesn't look like an hourglass. It looks like a vesica pisces.
Exactly.
You know, they really should have called it, you know, the Mandorla Galaxy.
Correct.
It's hard to get these guys to change their minds, you know? Okay, any other comments before we move on?
Allison says the shape also gives the impression of cell division.
Mm-hmm. It does indeed. In fact, it's not just an impression. It really, it's one of the positions. You know, the cells start as one circle, and then they move until they are two. In the intermediate stage, it certainly is very much like a vesica pisces. Yes. Thank you.
And then Orest has another comment.
Great. Orest?
What I'm sort of feeling strongly is that the vesica piscis is something more than the two parts. So from the two spheres is created something that would not be there if they weren't co-joined. It's like when two merge, something greater than the two comes about.
Absolutely. I think, in a sense, you put your finger on the most essential quality of the vesica pisces, which is that something that is of the two emerges that is yet altogether other than that. And I think that's why there's such an emphasis on the threeness, even though we're looking at two circles. You know, mathematically, you have the square root of three and the triangles that are formed and the three radii of the width of it. And so, yes, what you just said is, I think we're really getting to the essence of its subjective meaning right there, which is why it has been used so frequently from the Middle Ages as a representation of the father, mother, and the child, you know, in terms of the Holy Trinity. But I'll get into that in a second. Any other thoughts before we move on? Subjective qualities.
I think that Richard Tracy may have a comment. Let me see if...
Hey, Richard, welcome. This is the neighborhood...
There's
friend.
Two of you, so I just unmuted one. Can you speak?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Loud and clear. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Terrific.
I really don't have any comment. I'm just sitting here soaking it up.
Oh, okay.
All right.
BL thought you had your hand up to make a comment. Any others? Any other observations? Okay. Yeah.
Go ahead, Jocelyn.
Hi Jocelyn.
Hi, Francis. Well, this is a very interesting discussion, and I'd just like to add one little bit here about 1 plus 1 equals 3. And this is such a fundamental pattern or structure, we can ascribe any of the triplicities that we're familiar with to it. For instance, you know, spirit matter in relationship giving emergence to consciousness.
Absolutely.
And the consciousness being the middle principle, being the magnetic core that holds the spheres together.
I like that.
We could play with that for quite some time with different triplicities. But,
yes.
You know, they're all 1 plus 1 equals 3.
Yes.
Is a beautiful picture for that.
Right. It's enough to drive your second grade teacher crazy, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other ideas? Any observations?
I don't see any more hands or any more comments.
Well, that's a very rich offering. Thank you, everyone. Gave me some new ideas. And I've got a few to add of my own here. Let's see here. Orest mentioned this, which is the middle of the figure is a portal through apparent division, thus uniting the pairs of opposites. It's a graphic representation of the door into and from some state of awareness, which is determined by the two circles. Remember, this is a universal symbol. And as Jocelyn was mentioning, you know, you can play with all kinds of triplicities here. So the third quality, that which creates the portal, is determined, the nature of that third aspect, or that central aspect, I should say, is determined by the nature of the two circles. Its universality is one of its great appeals. Okay. For example, if we choose to have the circles represent spirit and matter, as we did in our last webinar, as Jocelyn just mentioned, their apparent division is characterized by consciousness. When the two circles, the Vesica pieces, are drawn horizontally, thank you, Claire, for bringing this up. The central position has been said to symbolize a cosmic. Oh, wait a minute, I'm behind here. When they're drawn horizontally, as they are here, the central portion is said to symbolize a cosmic womb. This was an idea Orest brought forward, through which all creation issues. This is truly the two becoming three. Right. Actually, that's not quite right. It's the one becoming three through the agency of the two. It's always useful to think of two-ness as a doorway, as an energetic, through which one is able to become three. Okay. So you see here all of creation issuing forth in mathematical terms. When the two circles are placed vertically, the Vesica pieces proper takes on the appearance of a fish, and you know, Vesica pieces literally means a fish's bladder, right? It can be no coincidence that these symbols are respectively that these are the symbols respectively for the Virgin Mary and the Christ, right? That you have the when the circles are horizontally placed, you have the womb, which is the Virgin Mother, and then when you have them placed vertically, we have the fish, which is the Christ. But the fish was revered in cultures other than the Christian, as was the Vesica pieces. The Celtic hero Finn McCool, I like the fact that we have both Finn McCool and Dual Cool. You know, if your last name is Cool, you are. Anyway, Finn McCool spent 7 years trying to catch the salmon of knowledge. Finally caught, Finn burned himself while cooking it, and as he sucked the juice of the salmon from his burnt thumb, the knowledge of the world flowed into him. It suggests a trial by fire, doesn't it? Okay. When the two circles are placed vertically, the Vesica pieces also represents a mouth, which, like the womb, is an instrument of generation. The ancient Egyptians were particularly aware of the importance of the mouth. Here's a depiction of the opening of the mouth ceremony, whose key utterance is, "My mouth is given to me. My mouth is opened by Ptah." Now, Ptah was the Egyptian creator god par excellence. He was considered to be the demiurge who existed before all things, and through the power of his will, thought the world into existence. So having one's mouth opened by Ptah surely must be a reference to initiation. It's suggests to me that you're speaking the wisdom of Ta. And so you've, at some level, identified with that great being. Interestingly, we find a similar concept in Psalm 51, verse 15. O Lord, open thou my lips, and my mouth shall show forth thy praise. So, the Vesa Kapisis can be a symbol for the path of return, like the middle path of Buddhism, which can be described in terms of the Libran keywords, I choose the way that leads between the two great lines of force. Now, one way to bring this concept into personal practice is to associate the two circles of the Vesa Kapisis with your own two eyes, and the middle portion then becomes the third eye, right? I mean, if you think of it as literally as a pair of glasses, right, that you put on, and therefore your left eye and right eye are coming together to form the third central eye. It's a way in meditation of bringing the potency of this figure forward. Now, before we go on, do we have any more additional thoughts on the meaning or significance of the Vesa Kapisis? Might have come up as a result of what I was just describing. Anybody?
I don't see any comments or any hands. I do see a hand. Go ahead, Arrest.
When you mentioned the mouth, the thing that came to me is the second principle of creation is sound. Mm. So this is the point for sounding.
Indeed. Yes. It's really the logos, the quality of the logos. You have the absolute, but when unmanifest is not sounding forth the word. When the material realm is reflected from the absolute, then you have this mouth formed, which is illustrative of the idea of the sounding forth of the word. Very good. Thank you, Orest. Any other ideas?
Yes. Leah, go ahead, please.
And so therefore it becomes the word made flesh.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. So, you know, it's interesting, you know, when you think of the quality of orifices, right? We have the eyes, the lips, and the yoni. All are a means for creation to come forth, right? And they're all represented by this symbol. You could say, in fact, that this symbol is the noumenal essence of all of those the facts of our physical creation, right? Any others?
Yes, Francis.
Hi, Kay.
Talking about the word made me think of Om, O-M, as the, mm-hmm. you know, the word. And some time back I discovered when chanting the great invocation, the very first word of each paragraph was from. And when you chant it, the from becomes the from. And
like
which introduces
om, yes.
the, yeah, like an om, which actually mm-hmm. gives energy to that particular paragraph you're saying. And I thought that was quite fascinating and interesting that formed the very first word of the its new paragraph.
Yes. And no accident either. You know, the I'm sure those words were chosen with painstaking care to also carry the vibration of the great invocation. Yes, thank you for that.
You don't get quite the same effect if you're just reciting it, you know. But when you chant it,
the
vowel sounds lengthen mm-hmm. out and mm-hmm. give that kind of, yeah.
Yes. Thank you, Kay. Any other comments before we move on?
Yes, we do. We have another hand. Hold on a second. Go ahead, Richard.
I was just making an observation of the, you know, the two circles representing duality and the Vesicabhisis for representing the solution, that oftentimes in esoteric worlds you're presented with right, wrong, left, right, up, down, and you're admonished to resolve that duality, and Vesicabhisis appears to be the symbolic vehicle to do that.
Yes, very good, very interesting observation. Yes, it's one way to think of it. The first figure to come forth from the Vesicabhisis is the equilateral triangle, right? And if you look as the top point of the Vesicabhisis, as that point of resolution for the pairs of opposites which form the base, you have, in a sense, the essence of what the Vesicabhisis bestows on the triangle, because it is, in truth, the parent of the equilateral triangle. Thanks for that, Richard.
You're welcome.
Okay, let's move on. We've got a lot to cover. Let's tackle DK's third phase in the contemplation of the symbol. Could we get a reader for this brief passage?
No hands yet.
Richard, do you want to read this? You have a sonorous voice.
Sure, yeah, absolutely. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Esoterically, this would cover the effect of the force or energy upon you and of the quality of the vibration it may arouse in you, perhaps in some center, perhaps in your astral body, or perhaps only in your mind.
Thank you, Richard. So having familiarized ourselves with the Vesicabhisis, let's seize the moment and reflect on where in ourselves this symbol affects us. As I mentioned before, keep in mind as you visualize that symbols, rather than being descriptions of potencies, are inherently potent. Thus, they have the potential to penetrate your consciousness and reveal a higher source. We'll take exactly 1 minute for this meditation, starting right now. Okay. If you'd like to share your meditation experience with me, I would be delighted to hear from you. My email address is on the screen here if you want to jot it down. Also, anytime you want to just comment on some of the subject matter, you just have ideas and you'd like to share them, I'm always open for that communication. So, as mentioned before, the first figure to emerge from the Vesicabhisis is the equilateral triangle. Let's take a look at the simplest of all polygons. First, some mathematical observations. This and only this polygon is unique in the fact that each point is both equidistant and equiangular in relation to the other two points in the triangle. No other triangle, indeed no other geometric figure, has this quality. Thus, we can say that the equilateral triangle is wholly symmetrical, a distinction it shares only with the circle. Both are both the circle and the triangle are ancient symbols for deity. The circle representing the unmanifest absolute, and the equilateral triangle, the spiritual trinity. Note in this painting that the master's drawing stick is held precisely at 60 degrees, the angle of an equilateral triangle, and that it forms the base corner of a larger equilateral triangle made up of the arms, head, and torso of the master himself. It suggests that he is in his own identity, conforming to the nature of the equilateral triangle. He's gazing at a transparent Archimedean solid called a rhombocuboctahedron, as though for inspiration. We're going to be getting into a study of the solids sometime down the line, the Platonic solids and the Archimedean solids. They're a fascinating study. But let's get back to the triangle and the circle for now, representing the absolute and the trinity through which it manifests, the father aspect, matter, or the mother aspect, and that which occurs when the two are united, consciousness, or the solar aspect. The Kabbalah states the deity is one because it is infinite. It is triple because it is ever manifesting. The Sefer Yetzirah states, God, the Exalted One, engraves his name by the three seraphim, numbers, letters, and sounds. This trinity can be found in all the major religions, past and present, from Osiris, Isis, and Horus, to the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, the latter a euphemism for the feminine principle. Curtis states in number one, the divine came down into manifestation. In two, it was met by the inertia of matter. But in three, it penetrated into matter and manifested the only begotten Son. So do you see how the ideas that we've been exploring, you know, what Richard said about, you know, the full potential being released in the third aspect, and what Jocelyn was talking about with the bringing the two to create a third that is altogether other than, but related to the two. Three was the Druid mystical number, represented by this symbol called Awen, which means inspiration. The design of this symbol comes from a myth similar to that of Finn McCool. In this myth, a sorceress named Kerry Dwin brews a portion in a magic cauldron for the prescribed 1 year and 1 day. On the last day, the cauldron was being looked after by a child named Gwion Bach, which means little innocent one. As he was stirring the pot, three drops of liquid flew out and burned his finger. Like Finn McCool, when he sucked his finger, the three gifts of poetic inspiration, prophecy, and shape-shifting flowed into him. Thus we have the symbol with the three dots representing the three drops from the cauldron and the three gifts or powers represented by the three lines. Now, this is a good exoteric definition of the symbol. But as sacred geometers, you must always take another look. Don't let the blind move your attention from further exploration. That's you always need to be looking for a further explication of a higher truth. So if we contemplate this for a moment, we can see right away that we have three points and three lines, which are the elements of a triangle, right? The Druids believe that three things are continually increasing: fire, intelligence, and life. They held three virtues to be supreme: courage, brotherhood, and selfless service. there's been a resurgence in the Druid movement. There's a number of, I guess you'd call them neo-Druids, alive and well. I'm sure Terry could tell us about this if he could get his mic to work. The Druids believe that three things are continually, an example of the equilateral triangle's importance to the ancients can be found in the fact that the location of Jerusalem was determined based on the attributes of the equilateral triangle. According to Stephen Jackson in his study on symbology called Rerum Fontis, when the sunrise is observed on the summer and winter solstice in Jerusalem, the angle separating the two is exactly 60 degrees. Notice that the petals in this early stylized map of Jerusalem form an inverted equilateral triangle. Instead of encircling the triangle, however, the circle acts as a central hub, still representing the one in relation to the three, more like a seed source of the three. This use of the equilateral triangle to divine the location of Jerusalem becomes especially interesting when we consider the symbol for Judaism, which, as you know, is made up of two equilateral triangles. Could it be that one is the summer solstice and one triangle the winter? But symbols using the using this triangle are not unique to Judaism. Here we have three equilateral triangles interlaced in the ancient temple at Chennai in India. The Kali Yantra, also of Hindu origin, is made up of a circle enclosing five down-pointed equilateral triangles, representing mastery of the five senses. We even find that the equilateral triangle was important in the construction of the Parthenon. It was used to determine the position of the main cornice, the underside of the architrave, and the distance between the central columns. Equilateral triangles are found in many ancient hieroglyphic forms, from Babylonian writings to Egyptian hieroglyphs to Mi'kmaq, the latter of people who lived on the eastern seaboard of Canada in ancient times. You can see here at the bottom that both very disconnected, both in time and location, that these two cultures chose the equilateral triangle to represent God or the exalted one. Excuse me just a moment. Okay. I was excited to discover that according to Manly P. Hall, the Comte de Saint-Germain wrote a book on the ancient wisdom teachings, all in ciphers, which he had bound in the shape of an equilateral triangle. You can see it there sitting on the table in front of Manly P. Hall. The advent of the triangle moves us into the second dimension, and thus we enter the realm of the visible, the third sense. Hazrat Inayat Khan says, well, actually, let's, I'm getting lonely here, so let's get a reader to step in and read this section. Anybody willing to read this?
No, yep, got one. Go ahead, Mar.
Hi, I guess I'm unmuted, yes?
Yes, you are, Mark. Good to hear
you. Okay, hello, everyone, and let's read. Seeing the nature and character of life, the Sufi says that it is not very important to distinguish between two opposites. What is most important is to recognize that one which is hiding behind it all.
So stay on the line, Mar, and read us this short sentence, too. This is from the Bhagavad Gita, which really says much the same thing.
One whose intelligence has attained to unity casts away from him both sin and virtue.
Thank you. Good to hear you.
Hey.
Yeah. So, Tunis highlights differentiation. threeness returns us to unity. Thus, three is the first number of completion, reflecting unity in manifestation, the symbol of which is the triangle within the circle. Iamblica says, three is the first to make actual the potentialities of the monad. In fact, the word Trinity comes from tri-unity, or three as one. We find reference to this completion all around us, the unity of time manifests as past, present, and future. The unity of space is described in terms of height, length, and width. The unity of a musical chord is made up of the root, the fourth, and the fifth. There are three primary colors. When combined and expressed as light, they return to their source, which is white. When expressed as pigment, they combine to form black, the absence of light. So you have like the poles of the sphere represented there, but the same axis. Atoms are made up of protons, neutrons, and electrons. There are thousands of such tripartite patterns in nature. As Michael Schneider points out, we don't learn our ABs or our ABCDs, nor do we say, hip hurrah. Something in our psyche recognizes the natural completion that is threeness. Thus is Hermes thrice great, which is the meaning of Trismegistus. Likewise, Sri 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 is the highest honorific given to India's holy men and women. We chant Om three times. Genies give us three wishes. The Greeks had three graces, three fates, and three furies, and three charities. Apollo's symbol was a tripod used by the Oracle at Delphi to pierce into the unseen realms. For three is a volitional number, as in ready, set, go, right? And the go is the point at the top of the triangle. It takes us through the door of two-ness into the realm of the many. The word threshold comes from the same root as three. But three also represents harmony. In fact, the Greek goddess Harmonia was born from Aphrodite, the ultimate feminine principle, and Ares, the ultimate masculine. In philosophical terms, these are the personifications of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. The Greeks equated the triad with prudence, wisdom, piety, friendship, peace, harmony, and unanimity. Three expressed as a triangle is a paradigm of strength and stability. In fact, it's the only polygon structurally rigid by virtue of its geometry alone. Arches gain their strength from their inherent triangularity. The first 3D solid, the tetrahedron, made up of four equilateral triangles, is the strongest, most stable of all structures. Plato said that, quote, surface is composed of triangles. Those of you who have worked with 3D computer programs know that before a computer can render any surface, no matter how complex or simple, it must first reduce that surface to a series of interlocking triangles. Okay, now that we have some sense of the innate quality of threeness, let's take a deeper look at its origins. In HPB's commentary on stanza one of the stanzas of Zan and the Secret of Doctrine, we learn that the absolute has three aspects. They are abstract space, duration, which may also be termed abstract time, and motion, characterized as the great breath. HPB says, well, let's get a reader for this. Someone would like to volunteer?
Come on, folks. No hands yet. Here we go. Go ahead, Mar, accept your... There you go.
The great breath is regarded as the breathing of the unknowable deity, the one existence, which breathes out a thought which becomes the cosmos. So also is it when the divine breath is inspired, Again, the universe disappears into the bosom of the Great Mother, who then sleeps, wrapped in her invisible robes.
Thank you, Mar. So here we have the first appearance of thought, right? Which, of course, bears no resemblance to any human thought. The great breath, which is called the divine breath, when it is in its phase of exhalation, which it is right now, is the advent of the third aspect of deity, intelligent activity. This divine breath is eternal, which means it pre-exists time as we know it. The curvilinear quality of the circle is both unbroken and undifferentiated. Thus, it is an appropriate physical metaphor for the great breath. It encloses and indeed gives boundary to the triangle, which represents the past, present, and future. Okay, now let's take a look at two verses from stanza 7. If we could get another reader, somebody like to step forward. If you've read before, that's perfectly okay. If you feel like reading, this is from my point of view, astonishing, what I would describe as searingly beautiful verses. So do we have a reader?
No volunteers yet. Come on, people. Nope.
Hey, just reading this will knock off a couple of years of karma for you. You know, it's so aligned with the sacred.
Oh, now you got lots now of people.
Suddenly I get hands. Okay.
Go ahead, Asha.
I'll take the karma. When the one becomes two, the threefold appears, and the three are one. And it is our thread, O Lanu, the heart of the man plant called Saptaparna. It is the root that never dies, the three-tongued flame of the four wicks. The wicks are the sparks that draw from the three-tongued flame shot out by the seven. Sorry about that.
It's all right, just finish.
The wicks are the sparks that draw from the three-tongued flame shot out by the seven, their flame. The beams and the sparks of one moon reflected in the running waves of all the rivers of earth.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Okay. During our webinar on tunas, we discussed the dropping of the non-eternal germ from the eternal egg, the point in the evolutionary process where chaos becomes male, female. Light issues from darkness, or as HPB says, the effulgence of the ray of primordial light dissipates total darkness by the help of the great magic power of the word of the central sun. But it is the coming together of water and light, or water incubated by light, that the, quote, threefold being issues forth. Remember, water and even light, as here used, stand in a causal relationship to the water and light that we know. In this stanza, we're looking at this interaction at its most noumenal levels. It's interesting how Blavatsky links light with the power of the word. Orest brought this up, actually, earlier. Both, as we know, are vibratory. Perhaps water and light are used in the stanza, are metaphors for two great rates of vibration, which, when combined, form a third, the threefold one, thus adding its own tone to the vibratory note of both its parents, to make a chord and a new unity. This new threefold unity becomes, we are told, the heart of the man plant called the Saptaparna, which means seven-principled or sevenfold man. There's a close link between the numbers 3 and 7, because whether considering the rays, the principles of a human being, or the planes of consciousness, the 4 always issues from the 3 to make 7. This relationship is shown by a triangle surmounting a square. So to continue with verse 3, and it is our thread, O Lanu, the heart of the man plant called Saptaparna. The thread, or Sutratma, is the linking element of the seven principles. We get a hint as to the identity of the three-tongued flame when we're told that it is the root that never dies, a reference to the spiritual triad, thus making the four wicks the lower quaternary. A letter in the Hebrew alphabet pronounced Shin stands for Shaddai, a name for God. Notice the grouping of the flames, all the more significant given the fact that Shin is the 21st letter of the old Hebrew alphabet and is thus associated with the Tarot Arcanum resurrection. Of course, 21 adds to 3, and in Gematria, Shin represents the number 300, a higher octave of the three. Shri, 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 3. I actually once wrote a song called Four Wicks Burning, an allusion to the life of the disciple based on these two verses. The second part of verse 4 reads, I'm going to go ahead and read this one myself. The wicks are the sparks that draw from the three-tongued flame shot out by the seven, their flame, the beams and sparks of one moon reflected in the running waves of all the rivers of earth. I couldn't possibly trace the meaning of this teaching more beautifully than does HPB, so I'll just present this slightly edited version of her commentary. Just as myriads of bright sparks dance on the waters of an ocean above which the moon is shining, so our evanescent personalities, the elusive envelopes of the immortal monad ego, twinkle and dance on the waves of Maya. They last and appear as the thousands of sparks produced by the moonbeams only so long as the queen of the night radiates her luster on the running waters of life. And then they disappear. The beams, symbols of our eternal spiritual egos, alone surviving, reemerged in and being as they were before, one with the Mother Source. So, the highest manifestation of threeness within the constitution of a human being is the spiritual triad called, in the stanzas of the three-tongued flame. Note that the flame is a unity expressed by DK in this chart by a triangle. That's the central triangle there, the odd-shaped one. Itself a downward extension of the equilateral triangle of will, wisdom, and activity, and spanning the seven subplanes of the monadic plane. Stanza 12 of the stanzas of Dzan from A Treatise on Cosmic Fire, a completely different set of stanzas, gives us some insight on the difference between these two triangles. This is stanza 12. Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. You had a couple of questions and...
Fine, let's hear them.
A couple of
And we're coming to the end of our time, too, so we're going to have to wrap it up.
Okay, all right. Rick, you've got yourself on self-mute, but I'm sorry, did you have a question? You're on self-mute, Rick.
So that means click your microphone and choose unmute.
Okay, now your hand is up, but I need you're still on mute, self-mute.
Okay, while you're figuring that out, did we have another one?
Yes, we did. Go ahead, Guadalupe.
No, that's okay. It's getting to the end of time.
Oops.
Well, that's all right. Ask your question. That's fine.
No, it was okay. It passed on.
Okay. Fine. Rick, were you able to figure out your microphone there?
I still have you unmuted, but it looks like you are self-muted, so I can see your hand is up, but I can't hear you, so
Okay. We're going to have to close here in terms of the... Now let me open this and come down. All right. Okay. There's nothing new on the reading list this time. However, if you haven't read, if you have access to these books, The Key to the Universe by Harriet and Homer Curtis, you know, I strongly recommend these chapters on the number three. They're really terrific. And then the Beginner's Guide to Constructing the Universe is always good and quite easy to understand. So we'll just give those in terms of the reading list. For meditation on the number three, I chose this old commentary from A Treatise on White Magic. Could we get a reader for this? Think in terms of the three while our reader is reciting this. Anybody like to read this?
Yeah, Rick, he's got his hand up and he's
okay,
unmuted.
I think I finally figured this out.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. When fire and love and mind submit themselves, sounding the threefold word, there comes response. The one eludicates a word which drowns a triple sound. God speaks, a quivering and a shaking in the form responds. The new stands forth, a man remade. The form rebuilt, the house prepared, the fires unite, the great and great the light that shines, the three emerge with the one, and through the blast a fourfold fire is seen.
Thank you. It's through the blaze, but I kind of like the blast because I'm sure it's a blast at the same time. Okay, for the other... part of this meditation, which you can take with you this month, choose any symbol that we looked at today. Of course, we talked a lot about the Vesica Pisces, but just meditating simply on the equilateral triangle, you'll be surprised at what a strong response it will evoke. So we're to the time of a closing invocation. I'd like to continue our work with the Great Invocation, but I'll be reading DK's Guided Visualization from Discipleship in the New Age, Volume 2, between the stanzas. So in order to set the tone for this segment, let us chant Om together silently. You can chant out loud since your mic's not on, and just chant with me. DK says, visualize the world situation as best you can, and in terms of your major world interest and with what knowledge of world affairs you may possess. See the mass of men everywhere, glowing with a dim light, and here and there points of brighter light where members of the new group of world servers and men of spiritual intention and of loving hearts are working for their fellow men. Then visualize, through the creative imagination, the vivid light of the hierarchy streaming towards humanity and slowly merging with the light which is already in men. Then say the first stanza of the invocation. Say this with me. From the point of light within the mind of God, let light stream forth into the minds of men. Let light descend on earth. Then ponder upon the reappearance of the Christ. Realize that no matter by what name he may be called, in the many world religions. He is still the same great identity. Reflect and speculate upon the possible results of his appearance. Then say the second stanza of the invocation. Say this with me. From the point of love, within the heart of God, let love stream forth into the hearts of men. May Christ return to earth. Endeavor to concentrate your fixed intention to serve and to spread love in your surroundings, and realize that insofar as you can do these things, you are attempting to blend your personal will with the divine will. Then say stanza 3 of the invocation. Please say this with me. From the center where the will of God is known, let purpose guide the little wills of men, the purpose which the masters know and serve. Consider practically what you can do in the coming weeks to further the preparation for the coming of the Christ. Then sound the Om 3 times, dedicating the threefold personality to the work of preparation. To me, this suggests that each Om is oriented towards each one of the threefold personalities. So as we chant the three Oms, think first in terms of your physical etheric, then in terms of your astral, and then in terms of your mental body. Om. 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 Rest. Interestingly, DK doesn't complete the Great Invocation in these instructions, making it a threefold invocation. But let's go ahead and finish it. Speaking with me, from the center which we call the race of men, let the plan of love and light work out, and may it seal the door where evil dwells. Let light and love and power restore the plan on earth. Om. Okay, these are instructions are on page 227 and 228 of Discipleship in the New Age, Volume 2, if you have access to that book. If you don't, you can go online and find it through luchastrust.org. Okay, that's it for today. Don't forget to throw a couple of bucks at the Moria Federation. Go to moriafederation.com and find the donate button, and this will help offset the yearly fee for the program we're using right now, which is the GoToMeeting account. And finally, keep spreading the word about this webinar. I'd love to see it filled to capacity. So thank you for attending, and I'll see you next time, which will be on November 16th. Okay, bye for now.
Francis, before you go, can you turn your Skype on, please?
Okay.
Thank you.
I will do that.
Okay.
Okay. Bye-bye.